Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2003, the Bush administration sent Noah Feldman to Iraq to help write the country's interim constitution. A year later, as some restless hawks make their case for pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq sooner rather than later, Noah Feldman argues that there is no cut-and-run scenario that works for Iraq or for the United States. Tonight on Point, America's commitment to Iraq, how deep it is, how long it is, and when it ends. We begin tonight in Baghdad with a report on preparations for upcoming Iraqi elections. Edward Wong is a correspondent for the New York Times. With violence flaring across the country and a fresh U.S.-led offensive launched on a string of small towns south of Baghdad today, I asked him if Iraq would be secure enough to hold elections on January 30th.
It all depends on who you ask. I think for the most part, a lot of people right now say that they're working hard to get everything in line for the elections. There's still 2.5 months left. The officials who are working on it sound optimistic about it. The United Nations official I talked to recently, Carlos Valenzuela, who's the head of the advisory team here, says that he's seen worse situations in other countries he's worked in. And in elections he has worked in, violence has forced them to close down a large percentage of polling places in some areas and registration booths in some areas. And the elections have still been seen as legitimate. So the bottom line is that there is going to be violence almost inevitably around Election Day, but that there is a certain level of violence that can still be tolerated and still have the elections be considered legitimate. Now, we don't know how high that level of violence will be, and basically that's what all the officials are trying or working towards right now, to try and dampen that violence. I know one of the issues at play right now is how the Iraqi security forces will be deployed around the polling booths or the voting centers to try and secure those from guerrillas or insurgents who might attack. An Iraqi official who's overseeing this tells me that they need 270,000 security officers in those areas, but that seems to be much higher than what might be available that day, or much larger than what might be available that day. American commanders say that they're training Iraqi security officers right now, but that by January there will only be 145,000 available to help out with security.
Edward Wong, give us a sense of where Iraqis will be voting if everything goes ahead as scheduled on January 30th. What kind of facilities will there be, and how many voting locations around the country?
Well, I think it'll actually be fairly similar to what we see in the U.S. The Electoral Commission tells me that they're trying to choose neutral places to have these elections. We're talking about schools and community centers, places like that. They don't want the polling booths to be located in anything that has anything to do with the military, whether it's Iraqi or American. They don't want the polling booths to be in any religious-oriented buildings. So they're trying to find politically, ethnically, and religiously neutral place. And there will be 9,000 of them around the country, from the Kurdish area in the north down to Basra and the areas right around the Persian Gulf.
They're talking about needing 270,000 security forces to work at the polls on those days to keep them safe, but they've only got, they're hoping, 145,000. Is there any plan in the works to make up the shortfall?
I think that's part of the discussions that will be ongoing in the next couple of weeks. They'll have to work quickly, obviously, because they need to start putting plans in place. As we know, this insurgency is very smart and very tenacious. One of the plans that they might look at is the official I spoke to, Wa'al Abdul Latif, who's in charge of the committee that will oversee this for the government. He said that you only need 270,000 for one day, so perhaps they might look at just hiring people for just that one day to make up the shortfall. But then, of course, that raises all these other questions. How do you properly screen for the people if you're hiring that many? And who can you rely on to really guard the booth if they're not going to be these fully trained security officers? And then, of course, there's talk among some of the militias that have been formed by the political parties to put up their soldiers to help guard the booths, especially the Shiite and Kurdish parties who want the elections to go ahead on time. But, of course, that's problematic, too, because you don't want individuals associated with political parties to be guarding these booths.
And what about American military forces? There have been so many circumstances where they've had to step into the breach. In Mosul, just a week or 10 days ago, we saw, 80 or 90% of the local police abandon their job when insurgents went on a rampage there. Will U.S. soldiers be helping out on Election Day or not?
Both American commanders and Iraqi officials say that it's not a good idea for U.S. soldiers to be anywhere near the polling centers because it might cause the outcome to look illegitimate by the fact that a force seen as hostile by many Iraqis is around the actual polling centers. So what the Americans and the Iraqis want to do is to keep the American troops somewhere on the perimeter, maybe in buildings in the city centers or something where they can respond quickly to assaults if there are large assaults where they're needed. And of course, as you pointed out, in a lot of cases, the Iraqi forces haven't been able to repel these assaults, and Americans have had to step into the breach. And when that happens, it'll be unclear how that might affect the perception of the elections.
We've seen the degree of violence that the insurgents have been able to bring very suddenly to very public civilian arenas. If there is widespread violence on Election Day, it's not hard to imagine people waiting in line and the suicide bombing path opening up, and that entire picture is just way too easy to imagine. What might the consequences be for Iraqi politics if violence seriously disrupts the January 30th voting?
The big question then will be, what about the results of the elections? I mean, certainly there will still be millions of votes cast despite whatever eruptions will take place. But the question will be, who was able to cast votes? What parts of the country were or were not able to cast votes? And was everyone who wanted to vote, did they have an equal chance of voting? There have been historical cases, for example, in Latin America, where in elections, because certain regions of the area were afflicted by an insurgency and the votes were not held properly in those areas, a lot of people cried foul when the election results came out. So that could be the consequence for these elections if there is a serious disruption.
Well, a big challenge, and it's coming up soon now. Edward Wong, thanks very much for your reporting, and thanks very much for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Edward Wong is correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with us from Baghdad. In the spring of 2003, the Bush administration sent Noah Feldman to advise on the drafting of the interim Iraqi constitution and the structure of the country's fledgling democracy. He was optimistic then. Now he might be described as determined, even as rumblings of a U.S. pullout grow stronger in Washington as the January election nears. Feldman is making the case for the U.S. to stay the course. The U.S. must stay until Iraq's democracy is real, Feldman says. If that looks costly, he says, the alternatives look worse. Tonight on Point, trying to define America's commitment to Iraq now. You can join the conversation. How long should U.S. troops stay in Iraq? What is America's obligation there now? And what is the best interest of Iraq and of the USA? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Noah Feldman, Associate Professor of Law at New York University. In 2003, he was Senior Constitutional Advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He's author of After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy. His new book is What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. Good evening and welcome, Noah Feldman.
Good evening.
How long should U.S. troops stay in substantial numbers in Iraq?
We need to be there until the Iraqis are capable of taking care of themselves fully. And that means, at a minimum, being able to establish law and order on the ground so that there isn't rampant violence the way there is now, and very possibly beginning to be able to defend their borders as well, because without that, in that rough neighborhood, they could be in real trouble. So elections, if they do happen in January, as one hopes they will, but there's no certainty that that will occur, are not the end of the story. We need to remain until there's a government that can actually govern.
You spent months in Iraq. You've watched along with the rest of us since then, and I'm sure watched closely. How long do you think that's going to take? Former Iraq war commander General Tommy Franks, said tens of thousands of American troops will stay in Iraq for 3 or more years. Does that feel right to you?
That feels right if and only if the violence actually begins to die down. If our present strategy of trying to suppress the insurgency while still bringing the Sunni Arabs into the political process succeeds, then I think we could actually begin to withdraw some U.S. troops relatively quickly and then gradually draw them down over the next several years. If, on the other hand, we're not able to suppress the insurgency, then we're looking at a much more difficult situation, raising much more serious questions of how long we should remain before we simply give up altogether.
Is there a limit in your mind?
I don't think there's a number of years that can be specified, but I do think that we can't responsibly leave Iraq until we know the consequences of our leaving will be something other than a failed state. That's the great worry that pervades my thinking. It's really the reason I wrote this book. As people on the left and on the right initially, whether they were opposed to the war or for the war, begin to now say, well, perhaps we don't owe the Iraqis anything. Perhaps we should just look out for our own narrow interests. I look to a time when Iraqis might be in a situation where our withdrawal literally would mean civil war. And if that occurred, then the consequences are going to be a failed state, which is a magnet for terror, which is bad for us, and real chaos in the lives of 27 million Iraqis, which is worse for them.
And do you think that essentially that's what it would mean if it happened in circumstances anything like what we see there now? Is it likely to mean civil war?
I think so. The Kurds in the north are not able to sustain a state of their own without an oil revenue, and that would come from the oil fields in and around Kirkuk. The problem is that the Sunni Arabs in the center of the country also can't sustain a state without that selfsame oil field. So at a minimum, Kurds and Sunnis would be facing off over the question of that oil and over the question of territory. Meanwhile, one couldn't easily break away the Shia in the south of the country from the Sunnis in the center because of Baghdad itself. Baghdad has just under 7 million people. And of that, probably 1.5 million are Shia, perhaps 2 million are Shia, and another million or a million plus are probably Kurds. These are all very, very general numbers because there hasn't been a census in a long time that's reliable. But the bottom line is you're talking about a city 14 times the size of Sarajevo with lots of different three major ethnic groups in it. And fighting between these groups in other parts of the country would be overwhelmingly likely to spill over into Baghdad itself.
I know this isn't where you want the country to go, and we'll get to your destination. But paint that picture. You've spent a lot of time there, Noah Feldman. You thought a lot about it. If it did go to civil war, and you know there are voices in the United States now saying, we just got to get out of there. How is that likely to, it would be bloody, no doubt, and brutal, but how is it likely to sort out ultimately?
It's very hard to predict in advance how that would happen. On the one hand, Kurds are a very well-trained and well-motivated fighting force. In fact, the only troops who have done a good job so far among the Iraqi National Guard forces have been Kurds. When you hear that a unit of the Iraqi National Guard is doing well, it tends to be a Kurdish unit. So they're a serious fighting force, they're well-motivated, and they would put up a real fight. On the other hand, they're outnumbered by the central Sunnis, and one could imagine that the Ba'ath Party, which is not entirely destroyed yet, it still exists in some reduced form, would reemerge as a serious leader of the Sunni population, and they're, as we know, capable of some seriously well-coordinated violence. So that would be a serious fight. It's not clear who would win, but what is certain is that a lot of people would die. Meanwhile, the Shia in the south are far and away the most numerous in the country, so that would give them a chance of prevailing ultimately, but they're not as well organized, and their militias have not thus far been the kind of fighting force that we're accustomed to seeing from the Sunni and the Kurdish side. So it's hard to predict exactly how it would come out. It would be an invitation to the surrounding countries to get involved as well. Iran would probably not want to stand by and see the Shia population absolutely routed. Turkey would be very, very concerned about an independent Kurdish state, and that's only to speak of two of the most important neighbors in the region.
You've been optimistic in the past about Iraq and its prospects. Are you optimistic as we speak tonight, Noah Feldman?
There's still a way out of this with something like an outcome that can work, but the odds of it happening, I think, are, we have to be honest, are being reduced day by day. That outcome involves the different groups in Iraq, the leadership of those groups, coming together to negotiate a real constitutional settlement. It's essentially a power-sharing arrangement among those elites, validated by a more general election, to choose a government that basically shares out the resources of the state and that basically respects human rights and civil liberties. That can still happen. The reason it can still happen is that the Sunni insurgency has not yet become an entirely irrational insurgency of the kind that will settle only for absolute victory or death. And as long as that's the case, as long as there's a political option available, we could still see the Sunnis coming round to the idea that they have more to gain by joining an Iraqi government in the future than they do by continuing their civil war indefinitely.
Noah Feldman, stand by. We're going to come back and jump right into the thesis of your new book, What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. Listeners, you can join this conversation. So what do we owe Iraq? And are you committed to the U.S. being deeply invested until Iraq is a secure, functioning democracy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American commitment to Iraq, how deep it is, how long it is, and when it ends. My guest tonight, Noah Feldman, Associate Professor of Law at New York University, author of the new book, What We Owe Iraq. You can join this conversation. Are you committed to the U.S. being deeply invested in Iraq until Iraq is a secure, functioning democracy? Or after the planned January elections, will you be eyeing the exits, ready to pull U.S. troops home? Is it America's job to fix Iraq, to stay and fight until it's right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Noah Feldman, everybody talks about interests in Iraq. You introduce very prominently the idea of ethics in the occupation, in nation building. Why are you putting ethics front and center?
If 27 million people are suddenly put in a situation where they have no government without their having asked to have their government removed, then someone's got to take responsibility for that happening. And that someone is the United States and the United Kingdom and the other countries that were involved in removing that government. And both as a matter of international law and, I think, as a matter of basic fundamental ethical principles, if you've knocked out the government, you have to ensure that there's something there to replace it rather than complete chaos and potential anarchy. And I want ethics to come into the picture because I think most Americans understand that even if you think we don't have a responsibility to third-party bystanders whom we pass on the side of the road, we do have a responsibility if, as it were, it's our car that hit them. And in this case, it is our car. We are the ones who chose to remove the government of Iraq. So we have a real responsibility to the Iraqis in that respect.
Is this the Pottery Barn rule, Colin Powell's you broke it, you own it rule writ large?
That rule, which is very nicely put, although I know Pottery Barn has denied that they have that rule, has two sides. It has a descriptive side that says, as a matter of realistic foreign policy, if you knock down a government and you don't do anything about it, the consequence is going to be real disorder in the region. And in this case, that's disorder over 10% of the world's oil reserves within a day's drive of another 30% of the world's oil reserves. So part of the you broke it, you bought it is, as a descriptive, realistic matter, it's in our interests, once we've knocked out the government, to get back in a serious way to restoring the country. The second part of the you broke it, you bought it rule is the ethical part. And that's the one that I'm trying to focus on in the latter part of the book when I say that it's not up to us to build a government for the Iraqis. That they can do for themselves. But it is up to us to create circumstances where they can build their own government. And that's what security is all about.
And as an ethical issue, or by extension, a moral issue, that stands there. But you say the ethical issue ties back around to national interests. And by that, in this case, I mean U.S. national interests.
It does. Look, I'm not so naive as to think that we would act totally against our own interests in promoting a policy of creating democracy in Iraq. But I think that from a practical perspective, there's no other option. We can't set up a strong man like Saddam again, because we destroyed the Iraqi military, and there's no player in Iraq with the capacity to dominate in that respect. So that's no longer an option.
It may well look attractive to a lot of people to do that.
It does look very attractive to a lot of people, and indeed, there were realists before the war who said that's what we should do if we've got to go in at all. But it's simply too late. There isn't a strong man who's capable of doing that simply because the country is too diverse and because there's no centralized authority that's capable of making that happen at present. We're the only major authority there. Last but not least, you know, the difference between what we've been doing in Iraq and classic imperialism is in classical imperialism, when you set up a government, you leave behind a government that's fully dependent on you, the outside power. Mm-hmm. So you stay in control. That's a true puppet. We have to be striving to produce a government that could actually stand on its own. And the only way it can stand on its own is if the Iraqis themselves find it to be basically legitimate.
Are you confident that that's what Washington, that's what the Bush administration really wants to do, to leave behind a government that can stand on its own with everything that suggests about its independence of policy and perspective from Washington?
Whether they intended it or not to begin with, it's what they're stuck with now. Because even in Washington, even among those who were most strongly in favor of this intervention, there's now a recognition that we're straining our military to the very edge of its capacities. So they don't want us to have to remain in that way for the long run. Furthermore, we've talked the talk about democracy, and now we're going to have to walk the walk. The election is very likely to bring to power a government dominated by moderate Shia Islamists who are strongly Islamic and strongly democratic, and frankly are not going to be terribly pro-American, and we're not going to be in a position to say, well, we don't like this government, so they're out the door. We're going to have to work with whoever is elected.
You write about flying into Iraq in the spring of 2003 in a military transport plane full of consultants, of advisors coming in after the invasion and the early occupation. You looked around the plane that night as you headed toward Baghdad, I guess, and you saw that everybody on the plane was reading books about the American occupation and reconstruction of Germany and Japan. You say that sent a chill up your spine. Why?
It astonished me because, although those were important examples of reconstruction, we were headed to a specific country, Iraq, which spoke a specific language, Arabic, and then a lot of people speak Kurdish, with its own culture, with its own ethnic divisions. And even I, who had done a PhD in Islamic studies, was desperately trying to acclimate myself to the details of Iraqi politics, Iraqi history, Iraqi life. And the notion that there's a kind of one-size-fits-all approach to these things, I think, was embodied in the people reading about the reconstruction of Germany or Japan after World War II.
And no one-size-fits-all. My guest is Noah Feldman. His new book is What We Owe Iraq. We're talking about what we do owe Iraq and the length and depth of the U.S. commitment there as we look out on it now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tina's calling from the Bronx in New York. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I just say this. I don't know how could anybody owes to Iraq able to pay. I don't believe United States government will ever able to pay to what it have done to Iraq. It destroyed Iraq. There are thousands and thousands, and so far it's been said is 100,000 young men, women, and also on the side of the United States, over maybe 2,000, and I don't know how many thousand are injured. How could you talk about what we will pay back, and how long, and how much more killing to be done before...
But, Tina, you know what President Bush says? President Bush says, Tina, we took a terrible tyrant and dictator out of there. We stopped the filling of mass graves. President Bush would suggest that the U.S. has done an incalculable good for Iraq.
I think it's better now Iraq than we're under Saddam Hussein, which is when he was doing the terrible thing. He was already friend. He was then friend with the administrator of this country, so... That's bogus, okay, to say that he was a dictator and he was. When he was friend with them. What's happened to Iraq right now? It's much, much worse.
Tina, let us pick it up with Noah Feldman, and thanks very much for the call. Noah, what about it? You put the question right in your title. Tina's turning around and looking at the kind of collateral damage of the U.S. invasion and saying it makes settling the ledger here with Iraq very difficult. What do you think of that argument?
Well, Tina is right that, as a practical matter, things in Iraq are bad right now, and that a lot of Iraqis, I think probably like Tina, think that we haven't done them a whole lot of good. On the other hand, it's also true that we did remove Saddam, and that's a remarkable accomplishment. But it's only a remarkable accomplishment to the Iraqis if we follow up on it by replacing him with a government of Iraqis that's capable of doing a better job governing and a less oppressive job governing than he did. So living up to the debt that we owe, I think, will not be easy at all. And I'm sympathetic to that aspect of Tina's comment. But I think that can't be a reason to disengage. We can't say, well, because this is going to be so difficult to do, because it's so hard to live up to our responsibilities, we shouldn't fulfill them at all. To me, that's an argument for giving it a serious effort with the resources that are necessary and with the commitment of American lives, which is part of what we're talking about here, that is necessary to reach an outcome that's at least an acceptable one. Walking away is just not going to satisfy even the first element of our duty.
Noah Feldman, you know that in Washington people are now looking at a kind of endless expenditure on Iraq, at the difficulty of the challenge there, and starting to come up with constructions that would justify the U.S. Leaving, many of them tied to the election in January. You've written that elections are not a ticket home for the nation builder, but we hear a lot of people saying other things. I'm looking here at the Boston Globe quoting Michael Vickers, conservative-leaning Pentagon consultant, longtime senior CIA official. He says, our large direct presence has fueled the Iraqi insurgency as much as it has suppressed it. Retired Army Major General William Nash saying he's resigned from the We Don't Have Enough Troops in Iraq Club. He says now we have too many. Others saying that we have to prove that the U.S. is a liberator, not an occupier, by getting U.S. troops out, by starting significant withdrawals, drawdowns of the force level soon, and maybe soon after those January elections. What do you say?
What I think is mistaken about that approach is simply that it doesn't contemplate what will happen when we get our troops out. It may be true that we have both too many troops in Iraq to make the Iraqis feel liberated and too few troops to actually produce security. I'm not saying that's wrong. I think there's probably something to that perspective. But if we are going to begin a kind of phase withdrawal that some of these commentators and writers and scholars are suggesting, you've got to figure out what's going to replace it. And at that point, people tend to wave their hands and say, oh, Iraqi troops will replace it. But we've seen that Iraqi troops have not been prepared, with the exception of the Kurdish troops, to succeed in battle. They haven't been prepared to stand up to the insurgents. So signaling to the insurgency that we are prepared to walk away is a terrific way for the insurgency to think, aha, let's redouble our efforts. We're close to our goal of success, which is getting the United States out. And then once they're out, we will be able to reassert our control over the country. And that is something that the United States cannot afford as a matter of its national prestige or its international commitment to finishing what it started. But it's also a matter that would be disastrous from the perspective of ordinary Iraqis, who would be plunged back into exactly the world they were in before the war, except with fewer basic services, with less infrastructure, and with less day-to-day safety.
More chaos and headed backwards. Noah Feldman, stand by. I want to welcome another voice into this conversation with a little different view. Jonathan Clark joins us from Washington. He's a research fellow in foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute, and he's part of the Cato task force that issued the report last summer, Exiting Iraq, Why the U.S. Must End the Military Occupation and Renew the War Against Al-Qaeda. Jonathan Clark, thanks for joining us tonight.
How are you?
Very well. And you, your group has written that the U.S. needs to get out of Iraq. Noah Feldman is saying, no, you've got to stay in there until you've got something that's stable and legitimate and durable and credible. Why are you saying go, Jonathan Clark?
Well, the Cato Institute, of course, was against the war in the first place. But what we're saying now is that the results of those who took us into the war, of the results of those who have administered Iraq since the belligerence ended, has really got us into such a deep hole. Chaos is the word that comes to mind today. We're not really making any forward progress. And we think that the reason that we're not making any forward progress has really got to do with the fact that the United States and its coalition partners are very much seen as an occupying power. And as an occupying power, you naturally stimulate what is really a nationalist response to you. And the idea that somehow you can overcome that nationalist response by intensifying your military presence there or trying to create new political structures there is, I think, far-fetched. And given that the prospects, therefore, of making a success of things is very remote, and I think this is nothing in a sense to do with Iraq particularly. This is really the history of occupying powers around the world over history. Given that the prospects of success are so slim, surely the best course of action is to reduce the very factor which is stimulating this nationalism, i.e. the occupying military force, and let the Iraqis therefore confront the fact that they are, in a sense, on their own. They have to make their own sensible, rational decisions. If we trust them to do that, won't they come up with the solution that's going to be durable?
Jonathan Clark, stand by. Noah Feldman, you know the Cato Institute's line that Iraq distracts attention from fighting al-Qaeda. It emboldens a new class of terrorists to take up arms against the Middle East. It's enormously costly for American taxpayers. It undermines attempts to foster political and economic reform in the region. And to all that, Jonathan Clark says the very presence there stimulates a nationalist response. We need to let Iraq be on its own. Your response?
I agree with some of it. I mean, I agree that in terms of our image in the Middle East, in terms of our capacity to promote peaceful democratization, which is something that I've been arguing for a while, Iraq has, in fact, made it much more difficult. Where I disagree with this view is in its interpretation of the insurgency as solely a nationalist insurgency directed against the United States, with the implication that if the United States withdrew, that insurgency would simply reach a peaceful solution with the Shia and the Kurds. There's no reason to think that that's the case. This insurgency is a direct continuer of the Ba'athist regime. Not that every single person in the insurgency was a Ba'athist, but most are Sunni Arabs who benefited from the overwhelming favoritism towards them that was practiced by the regime. And some are certainly regime members. And if we leave, essentially, we can expect that insurgency to redouble its efforts, because if it can defeat the United States of America, which is what it would be doing, make no mistake, it will then be certain of its capacity to defeat the Shia and perhaps the Kurds as well, and to reassert traditional Ba'athist control over the country.
Jonathan Clark, what do you say? It's not just nationalist, it's Ba'athist, it's kind of going back to Saddam Hussein's crew.
Well, clearly the present insurgency is coming from the Sunni areas, but let's think back 3 or 4 months. Then the insurgency was coming from the Shiite areas. Now, the reason that they were, that is, in a sense, died down, is that we were able to buy them off by, in a sense, promising them political hegemony in a newly founded Iraq. And that is, in a sense, the source of what is exactly happening now in the Sunni areas. So what I'm trying to say is that the longer that the United States, as a sort of transcendent power, remains there, these tensions are not able to be worked out between the Iraqis themselves. And therefore, you have a recourse to arms, because the Sunni Arabs feel that the occupying power, the coalition, is in fact stacking the deck against them. Therefore, they are going to resort to the only means they have for pushing back against that, namely resort to insurgency, terrorism, whatever you want to call it. But if the occupying power were to withdraw, then the Iraqis would suddenly have to have a clear responsibility for themselves. And they might look over the abyss and plunge over it. On the other hand, they might look over the abyss and draw back. And I think that is more likely than the fact that the prediction will be civil war.
Jonathan Clark, are you saying they might look over the abyss and fall over it, and that's okay, that's just the way it goes, that's just the price of this whole interaction?
What I'm saying is that if you look back over the history of this particular region, and let us remind ourselves, this is not the first appearance in this region of Western reformists trying to bring about democratic constitutions. I mean, you look back right into the closing days of World War I, the Sykes-Picot Agreement divvying up the Ottoman Empire. If you look back to other attempts in the democracy game, the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran, the Western powers have had a fairly checkered record when it comes to establishing democratic governances in this part of the world. And I don't think that we should really have any illusions that we're able to buck that particular historical record. My guess is that the Iraqi people, if they are confronted with the necessity of somehow keeping themselves together, they will then look at that responsibility and respond to it intelligently and rationally.
Noah Feldman, are you nursing an illusion here? What if it just can't be done? What if the goal that you've set out as the ethical, the proper goal of nation building, what if it can't be delivered?
If it were truly impossible to accomplish a peaceful settlement there, then I think it would clearly be unethical to try to do it. And then I think Mr. Clark would be right. But what disturbs me deeply about the approach that he's advocating is the entire absence from that discussion of any recognition that we, collectively, the United States and the United Kingdom, did in fact remove the government, did in fact create this situation. And even though one might have opposed getting involved in the first place, one is still part of the collective that bears this responsibility, I believe.
We'll come back and look at just that. Jonathan Clark at the Cato Institute, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Very welcome.
We're talking about the American commitment to Iraq tonight, how deep it is, how long it is, and when it ends. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Noah Feldman. His new book is What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. He spent some time doing some of that nation building himself as the former senior constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, working on the interim constitution there. He's still very much engaged, as are most Americans these days, in thinking about Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. Our bloody realities on the ground making Noah Feldman's high ideals look unrealistic or more important than ever? Is the United States really committed to the long haul in Iraq if necessary? Are you? And when is enough enough? When is it time to go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Matt is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind, Matt?
Oh, okay. I just heard a couple of the people calling in earlier, and I called to respond. But
please, let's hear it.
everything that Mr. Smith from the I believe he's from the Cato Institution has had to say is really hitting the nail on the head.
Jonathan Clark, but he's saying get out. Do you agree?
He's saying get out?
Yes, sir.
I thought he was. I'm sorry. Then it was the other gentleman.
Noah Feldman saying hang in until you've got a stable government here.
Okay, then it was. I've been on the phone with you.
Yeah.
His contention that it would break down into a civil war is absolutely true. I spent a year in Ramadi, Iraq, and
in what capacity, Matt? In what capacity?
I was an intelligence officer
with the U.S. Army.
With the U.S. Army at the brigade level.
Okay.
So the intelligence that I provided was for about 5,500 soldiers.
Okay.
Who ran Ramadi and the town of Habaniya, which joins the city of Fallujah.
Tough territory. And what did you see? What did you conclude about the U.S. effort from there?
The largest thing that was striking was the lack of guidance from our higher headquarters. As far as at one point, I was told that, you know, this part of the country, being Ramadi and Fallujah, was an economy of force, and the United States Army and the United States government didn't care about it. We care about Baghdad. We have to stabilize the capital. And in the words of a 3-star general, the rest of the country can go to hell. So it was not only from a morale standpoint, but from a work standpoint, from the soldiers working every day, that they're caring about it became pretty low after that, and that was about February.
And Matt, let me ask you to speak to Noah Feldman's title here. What do you think the United States owes Iraq now? How long should the U.S. stay until what is accomplished?
Thomas Feldman made the contention that while we will probably not Thomas Feldman, Thomas Friedman made the contention that while we will not install a democratic government, and we certainly will not within the next 2 years, it can't be done, our job should be to tilt the playing field towards democracy and towards a stable government. And really, truly, it will be a generation before you see the true results of our occupation.
Do you mean a generation of U.S. troops in big numbers in Iraq?
I couldn't say what numbers or in what capacity, but if we pull out today, his statement that it will break down into civil war is absolutely true. You know, every single person that we every single person that we detained, you know, when we searched their houses, one of the biggest fears of the Sunnis was that, you know, the country was going to break down into civil war.
Matt, we've got it, and you saw it firsthand, and we thank you for that call. Noah Feldman, let me ask you about something that's been raised throughout this conversation. Jonathan Clark raised it again, the sort of implication that nation building itself is intrinsically a kind of colonial undertaking. You specifically don't want it to have that shape or that form, but is it avoidable? Isn't there something kind of just baked in the cake that where you're presuming a superiority, a supremacy as an invading, occupying power that's doing the nation building? How do you get away from that dynamic that elicits a nationalist and what we're seeing, a very violent response right now?
The first thing you do is you acknowledge it. You admit that nation building does have both an imperial and a colonial past, that if you describe our responsibility as being a trustee of the Iraqi people's power to govern themselves while we're governing it, that idea also has this very, very disturbing paternalistic legacy. And then having acknowledged that, you try to identify what parts of the job could still be performed ethically. I think one thing that we can't do is assume that we know how to build a government better than the Iraqis do. But if you speak to some of the Americans who are over there, and your caller Matt is a good example, and I just want to thank Matt for his service because he was out there with his neck on the line for people like mm-hmm. us, like me, certainly when I was in Baghdad, mm-hmm. people like that did not come in with the view that these Iraqis are ignorant people who need to be instructed in the last little detail of how to run democracy. Instead, young officers were out there doing their best, many of them civil affairs officers, many of them reservists, just trying to figure out how to enable Iraqis to vote for their own leaders and make their own decisions. So you can go some distance if you say, look, we're going to leave the institutional design to the Iraqis. We're just going to do the business of providing a safe and secure environment. And had we provided that with sufficient troops up front, there would have been already much more opportunity for Iraqi domestic politics to emerge. Last but not least, if we work with whatever government the Iraqis do, in fact, elect, rather than saying, we don't like this government, we want some government that's more to our liking, then we will be able to communicate to Iraqis, not overnight, but over time, that we're not trying to gerrymander the system to give us a government that we want, and that therefore we're not behaving like a classical imperialist.
I wonder if the U.S. is really capable of such a hands-on approach. Let's get one more, hands-off, I should say. Let's get one more call. Shabnam is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Shabnam, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I'm just tired of listening to Mr. Feldman and his condescension towards the Iraqis. I mean, why don't you just speak the truth? The only reason the USA is there is to sell off Iraq's assets to foreign investors, to destroy its Islamic heritage, as you can see by the bombing and destruction of Najaf and Fallujah. And who is Mr. Feldman to help Iraqis write a constitution? I mean, the Iraqis have a 1,400-year-old a legacy of Islamic law.
They also had a tyrant and mass graves.
They had a tyrant who was supported by the U.S. He was a puppet of the Americans. Mr. Rumsfeld was there during the time when he was poison gassing the
So first. What should happen now, Shabnam? What should happen now?
The thing is, if there was justice in this world, if the only thing the Americans have that the Iraqis don't is the bombs, okay? That's what enables them to make the black into white and white into black.
So justice just to give the bomb to Iraq as well?
No, the justice would be for the Americans to get out and for their leaders to be tried as war criminals and for reparations to be paid for 100,000 people who have been killed.
Shabnam, are you Iraqi by birth?
I'm not Iraqi, but I am so angry that I cannot believe this. The lies and lies that come out especially from NPR, which is different. I expect a different standard from NPR, which should be different from talk radio. But
Shabnam, we've got it loud and clear. Our time is running short, and I want to give Noah Feldman a chance to respond. Whoa, you can hear the anger right there that this intervention has blown up big time, and it's not very pleased to hear you pontificating on the future of Iraq. It wants the U.S. out.
Look, it's not an unreasonable view that she's got, and I want to be sympathetic to it. I understand the feeling that we ought not to be telling Iraqis what to do, and indeed, I don't want to tell Iraqis what to do. I want Iraqis to design their own constitutional institutions, and by the way, as an advisor to Ambassador Bremer, that's exactly what I advised. Let the Iraqis write their own constitution. That's the way that it ought to be done, not for us to write it for them. But look, let's also be realists. The Iraqis are not in a position where they can sit down and design their own institutions if they're still shooting at each other. And I fully acknowledge that the United States played a role in creating the situation. We removed Saddam, which opened up the circumstances where the civil war in utero, as it were, could emerge. We also did not have enough troops to really protect ordinary Iraqis from the insurgents, and we still don't have enough. And one of the consequences of that under-resourcing has been the fighting in Najaf, for example, that did do some serious damage to the shrine of Imam Ali there.
Noah Feldman, so, we just got 1 minute left. I have to ask you, your gut check on the Bush administration, do they have the commitment to do what you think is proper and necessary in Iraq?
The commitment seems to be there, but the execution simply hasn't been. And that's not enough. To have good intentions and be unable to put them into practice will not get us to an ethical outcome.
So your level of optimism, pessimism, as we talk tonight?
There's still a chance. This is not entirely over yet. But the chance is a narrow one, and we have to actually take it by making sure that we produce security, and having done so, turn it over to Iraqis to design their own institutions, their own constitution, and design a future for themselves.
Well, tall orders on absolutely every front. Noah Feldman, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us tonight. It's terrific to have you. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Noah Feldman, author of What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, Dan Rather announces he's stepping out of the anchor's chair. This is On Point. After nearly a quarter century in the anchor chair, Dan Rather is stepping down as anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. The 73-year-old anchorman announced today that his last broadcast will be March 9th, 24 years to the day after he took over duties from Walter Cronkite. In September, Rather was embroiled in a controversy over his reporting on President Bush's National Guard service during the Vietnam War. CBS is not the only network with changes at the top. Next Wednesday, after a 21-year run, Tom Brokaw gives up his NBC anchor chair to Brian Williams. Bob Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. He joins me now for a look at the changing of the old guard in network TV news. Bob Thompson, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So here goes Dan Rather, and I'm sure it's not the way he hoped to go with the cloud of the controversy in the fall hanging over him.
No. No, it's not. I mean, this is a guy that did some really good, serious broadcast journalism in his time. I remember him being dragged from the 1968 Democratic Convention. He did a lot of good field work and really has left a significant legacy and was, of course, the person who kind of brought CBS News into the era of cable. But, of course, he's also always going to be remembered for this big controversy that ultimately led to his departure that's probably a little earlier than it would have been otherwise. What's really curious about this announcement is that the whole controversy took place not on the evening news, but a story on 60 Minutes, and he is returning to the scene of the crime. He's going to continue on 60 Minutes. He's just stepping down from the anchor spot. I find that very curious.
But it's a much less prominent position. He had two more years on his contract as anchor, but the CBS News has got this internal report going, and it looks like Dan Rather may be scooting out ahead of its report, which may be critical of him and the National Guard reporting.
Well, I think he's absolutely scooting out before the report. I mean, this clearly was part one. That report is obviously either done or close to it. We were expecting it after the election. The buzz on the street is that it should be due out at the end of this month. So this was step one. If, in fact, though, it ends up being very critical, I think CBS is going to have an interesting question to answer, which is, if this was such a problem on a story he did at 60 Minutes, why is he still, you know, reporting for 60 Minutes?
And Bob Thompson, what about the departure now? Dan Rather, already Tom Brokaw, these big war horses of TV network news headed out at the same time when there's all kinds of question in the air about the future of television news. Is there a chance for TV news to be revived and strengthened, or are we heading into a new era? What's it look like?
Well, the chance is certainly there. I mean, a lot of people are talking about this being an end of an era. It is an end of an era. It's the end of the Rather era. It's the end of the Brokaw era. I think the old network evening news, though, has still got a few tricks up its sleeve. And frankly, given the numbers that it gets, which are significantly higher than the aggregate numbers of all of the 24-hour cable channels put together, I don't see any reason to believe that whoever replaces Dan Rather and Brian Williams replacing Brokaw might not sit on those thrones for just as long as their predecessors did.
And with the same style of journalism as Rather?
Well, that's going to be a little different. I mean, clearly Brian Williams, who I think was a great choice for Brokaw's replacement
at NBC, yeah.
At NBC, he brings, of course, the gravitas of kind of a traditional network news anchor, but at the same time, he brings with him the whiff of the frontier of cable news, where he cut his teeth. And that is going to be a different broadcast with him there, and that ultimately might be good for NBC, which is all of these networks, I think, have still got the great Cliff Notes, Reader's Digest, 30-minute report of what goes on. Cable doesn't do that as well. The question is, those shows have not changed much in the last several decades, and I think maybe it might be time for a little update. And by that, I don't mean bringing in MTV reporters. I mean simply assessing what it is they do and what they do better than cable does.
Bob, in just a half minute we've got left, one thing this next generation may not bring is the same stripes or scars of experience in the field.
Well, that's true. I mean, just like political candidates no longer have, World War II to come from, this is a whole new generation of people that did have different sets of experience. That doesn't necessarily mean, however, that these networks couldn't bring in some really solid journalists that could start their own legacies.
Well, March sees Dan Rather leaving the chair. And, of course, as we said, Tom Brokaw going next week. Bob Thompson, we'll keep an eye on all of it. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson at Syracuse. He is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Rachel Dornhelm and Michael Garth, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.